Secret of the Dormant Brain Lab, The Adventures of Niles Abercrombie and the Book of Wands, Volume 1, by Neil Slade, read by the author.
Warning. This book should be kept out of the reach of children. It is advised that adults in the possession of this book take precautions to keep it hidden in such places so not as to arouse interest in readers under the age of 18, and certainly in the case of potential readers under the age of 12. Recommended areas of safekeeping include, but are not limited to, refrigerator vegetable compartments and laundry areas, as well as more obvious, hence unlikely spaces such as bookcases and library shelves. It is suggested that such hiding places be rotated for the most effective levels of security.
The publishers are not responsible for any damage.
Thank you.
The Book of Wands. Book of Wands, Way of Wands, 1. Greetings.
I am the Book of Wands. Nice to meet you. You might be expecting to be reading a book. This is different. I show the Way of Wands. And this has inspired some to fondly refer to me and my method as Bow Wow. Book of Wands, Way of Wands. The paper leaf ensemble, thusly. You know that you aren't the clothes that you are wearing. Similarly, these pages are also only just my clothes, what I'm wearing at the moment. You are holding my socks. What you see are letters printed on a page, symbols made up of microscopic smudges imprinted on bound sheets of flattened dried wood pulp, what people commonly refer to as a book. Indeed, however, I am in fact not just a bunch of sentences, a few hundred paper pages that have been stitched together in the basement of a print shop in a dusty old building on the outskirts of a big city far away. Rather, this is my portrait, a paint-by-number ink-splat collection bound together, pages that are perhaps stapled together here or loosely thrown in a box over there, or maybe even glued on a paper spine in another place. Instead, I am the originator. Please focus beyond what you read to see me. Thank you. I thought this thought, which was then hammered out by someone's fingers on a clickety-clack letter-embossed checkerboard. Tappity-tap-tap-tap dance duet of two hands into a code of reflected light and dark now shining upon your face. I tickled someone's brain to excitedly wiggle his 10 fingers over a keyboard, and that produced this arrangement of marks that lightly scurry over your rods and cones like a team of untamed hamsters on ice skates. Tickly, tickle, tickle. Scurry, scurry, scurry. In the case of an audible incarnation of one form or another, a human speaking my words with their mouth and perhaps captured on a recording of some sort, I ride upon compressed airwaves like a bronco buster upon a wild horse of crazy ideas. The steed gallops full bore out from the corral of vibrating vocal cords and dances around the rodeo ring of a vibrating paper cone inside a cheering speaker box. Ride 'em, cowboy! I continually twist and turn at the speed of light. I am an aural pixie, skipping across iridescent purple in organic atoms, then shaking hands with glowing blue organic electrons at the entrance of a grinning neural network. I enter your inner ear labyrinth, whirl around your cochlea whirlpool into your cranium like a super silly microbe on a lubricated water slide. Zip, zap, soup. So then, this is me transmitting direct to you through one code or another. Hello. Still, to be clear, I am not the duplicated sound dancing on the internal high wire of a reader's throat. I'm not a celluloid record-bound wiggle, nor the dancing trapeze wire signals inside a human's brain, nor am I the printed lettuce and tomato in an ink sandwich between two hardcovers. I live outside any container, flesh, bone, wood, paper, metal, or otherwise. Understand this, and you too will be set free. See me as I truly am, and you will begin to travel. And to travel, my good friend, is to live.
Chapter 0, Prologue. We had driven up the Mount Evanescence Road, riding in a sleek white mouse-sized vintage sports car. We pulled in next to a giant granite boulder that was perhaps 10 or 12 feet high. The rock dwarfed the vehicle, as one's hand might overshadow such a diminutive furry rodent. We locked the car and took a good look around. Here we were at over 12,000 feet elevation, stepping out onto the gravel, a small pullout, a minimalist parking lot, if you could call it that. There was virtually nothing about but small alpine plants and stone as far as the eye could see. Much of it looked just like the Scottish Highlands, but that place was on the other side of the globe. The air was cool, and the sky, what parts of it we could see through the clouds, was a perfect and flawless cobalt blue. I had been to the place we would soon be hiking at many times before, onto an area of the mountain that few tourists knew about or had bothered to explore. I had collected enough strange tales to fill a volume. I knew Bobby was in for an extraordinary experience. However, in no way could I predict exactly what that experience would be. The place was mystery personified. Here above the timberline, we were very nearly completely removed from our everyday life, detached from the energies and influences that effectively contaminate the consciousness of everyone who is in the middle of that madness we call civilization. Remarkably, we were barely an hour's drive from the metropolitan area that we lived in. Looking east, we could see the sprawling city far below us through a thick, humid haze, as if we were looking down on Earth from outer space, a gaseous cloud of cosmic vapor between us and the rest of the universe. "This is amazing," my young student Bobby said. This is like another world." And we hadn't even walked away from the car yet. I went around to the trunk and opened it. It creaked. "Take a wand," I said. "Do you want the cane or the umbrella?" I scratched my nose. Bobby looked up. "Looks like it might rain. I'll take the umbrella." "Good choice," I said as I handed him the unusual and rare wangy-handled tool. It was among my favorite wands, and I was certain that he would pick up something good with it. The signals were exceptionally clear in that area, and I was certain it would afford him access to information that he would never be able to get otherwise. That the umbrella might keep him dry, if necessary, was almost entirely besides the point. I took the Chinese sword cane for myself. I was actually relieved because, frankly, I didn't think he had enough experience to use it yet. He was still pretty green, and he might end up putting a hole in his foot or worse, even though the sword was for the moment safely sheathed inside the hollow barrel of the cane. The whole purpose of our expedition was to cement in Bobby's mind the experience for himself that he was surrounded by unusual tools, tools that everyone else took for granted as being nothing special at all. It was my hope that he would at least see that these very tools could open up doors for him, that these tools could launch him far from his common experience into other worlds that otherwise seemed only a dream. It was my hope that the two wands we had brought with us high into the mountains would reveal their potential in a manner that he could no longer deny as nothing more than my fertile imagination. Nearly everyone else on the planet thought that the idea of wands was just make-believe. Nearly everyone else on the planet thought I was out of my mind when I brought up the topic, an increasingly rare event. Until now, my dear reader. Not unusual that people think I'm out of my mind, but rare that I broached the topic in public. We removed our packs from the back of the car and I shut the trunk. You know, I once locked my keys in the car out here seconds after my friend told me not to. Took us about 5 hours to get to the nearest town and find a locksmith. I held up my keys in my hand. Won't do that again. Why don't you get one of those magnetic key holder things? Bobby asked. This, I paused dramatically, is a plastic car. I patted the fender affectionately. I had driven us up in my little white 1965 Lotus Elan. This was a very rare and very tiny fiberglass sports car, a 120-mile-per-hour streamlined go-kart that made any sleek Chevy Corvette or Ferrari look absolutely obese. The little British urban racer ate up Colorado mountain roads like an effortless quick snack between breakfast and brunch. Years before, in a colossal demonstration of being in just the right place at the right time, I had managed to acquire the car with not much more money than a family might spend on a few days' vacation at Disney World. I'd wanted one of these since I'd been 14 years old, but any more, they were impossible to come by. For me, the car was a testament to the power of real magic in transporting one to one's dream world. I pulled on my backpack and began to walk on an almost imperceptible dirt trail. The faint path wound away from the car park towards the backbone of a peak that lay in the short distance in front of us. Follow me, Bobby. The best is right up here, just ahead. You haven't seen anything yet, I enthusiastically predicted. Sure enough, a moment later, ack! Something gnarly had painfully caught my foot, and not just 6 feet from the car, I stubbed my toe on a sharp rock that was jutting out from the trail. I barely kept my balance. I stopped and rubbed my toe, grimacing and wobbling on the unstubbed leg. Ha, 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 Bobby laughed. Oh, man, how long have you been giving these guided tours? Ha, 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 ha. Bobby was so busy laughing at me that he stumbled on the very same rock himself. He did a jumbled and twisted clown ballet pirouette and then fell flat with a big thump on his rear end. I smiled broadly with a decidedly self-satisfied grin. Ha, ha, ha. My sore foot completely stopped hurting. Shut up, he said, embarrassed. He pushed himself up and dusted off his pants. Bobby, people who live in house glasses shouldn't stow thrones, I commented. What? Bobby questioned with a furrowed brow as he picked several small pieces of embedded gravel out from his palms. Forget it, I smiled. You okay? Yes, thank you very much. I was more than three times the age of my young teenage guitar student, my traveling protege on that day. Unlike myself, he'd never made the excursion before to that unique high-altitude paradise. I knew the landscape as well as I knew my own urban backyard, but the place still retained its secrets from me, even in the many spots that I was intimately familiar with. I never tired of exploring every nook and cranny up on that mountain, and there seemed to be an endless supply of both. On brief reflection, however, I must honestly admit I have actually no idea what a cranny is, or what might distinguish it from a nook. We had driven a few miles up the long, winding road that peeled off from the main two-lane highway, now a long distance below. There was no sound at all. We hadn't seen another single vehicle of any type. Although the road commonly had cars traveling the majestic scenic lane during any summer weekend, I had purposefully chosen a weekday for this trip to avoid exactly that. I wanted the mountain to ourselves. We certainly wouldn't run into anyone off the road and to where we were headed, onto the edge of a long line of rocky cliffs. We might see a pika or a crow, but I expected few other moving creatures, save a bug here or there. We had now walked several hundred yards from the car and quite a vertical distance in elevation higher up. Our vehicle now looked like a matchbox-sized toy car far below us. We zigzagged the most crooked, indirect path, winding higher and higher in between the boulders ever increasing in size. The wildflowers surrounded us and were at their most colorful and splendid peak.
"Look at this!"
Bobby exclaimed with surprise, his sudden dramatic outburst taking me by surprise as well.
"These flowers! This is incredible! They're huge! They're absolutely huge!"
I turned around and looked at him as he held aloft a tiny blossom. I was puzzled and didn't quite understand what he meant. They were just regular little wildflowers.
"Huh?
Huge?" I queried. Bobby held up a picked purple stem right in front of his one opened eye, looking back down at the lotus far below.
"Niles, look! This flower is actually bigger than your car!"
It took a second, but I then smiled and understood the joke. "Hey, you're not supposed to pick flowers up here. It's a nature reserve." I frowned slightly and shook my head in disapproval.
"Oh, sorry."
Bobby knelt down and made an utterly ridiculous attempt to replant the flower back in the ground. He was mocking me in a good-natured way, as was his habit. His pantomime, actually, was absurdly funny. "Forget it. Just don't pick any more. If everybody who came up here picked one flower every day for the next 10,000 years, pretty soon there wouldn't be any left," I lectured.
"Huh,"
Bobby said.
"Funny."
However, the reality was that it was actually prohibited to pick anything up in this wilderness. Tourists had already created significant damage to the ancient forest that lay half a mile downhill from where we hiked. Mount Evanescence was home to some of the oldest trees on the entire planet, bristlecone pines, the oldest living things on Earth. We walked a mere quarter mile above them and could see the ghostly, odd-angled dark branches of the enchanted forest peeking through the ground fog below us. Any moment, I expected to see goblins run out from behind one of the nearby truck-sized boulders we passed and dash off into the dark woods below. Before the area was protected by law, and surely even afterward, tourists had regularly picked up and taken away gorgeous pieces of ancient dead wood that was an irreplaceable part of the natural environment. Close to the road itself, where people drove to access this area, the ground was nearly as bare as a beach. But up where we were hiking, the story was different. We were above tree line itself, which we could see as a distinct border several hundred feet below us. Where the forest came up the hill nearer to where we were, far from the road, it was too far for lazy flatlanders to venture. This end of the enchanted forest remained pristine and whole, unspoiled, and unpicked. There was an incredible abundance of wildflowers everywhere. There were purple sparklers that looked like violet fireworks shooting off a green rocket trail with gold bursts in the center of each brilliant blossom. There were snow stars hugging the ground, no more than a quarter inch across each, as delicate as fairy footprints. There were football field-sized patches of Indian paintbrush here and there in an infinite variety of subtle shades of ruby, scarlet, orange, and yellow. And then there were the giant Pluto heads, big, green, round balls of spikes that truly looked like they belonged at the bottom of an extraterrestrial ocean. It was impossible not to stare at our feet as we climbed higher and higher towards the crest of the peak in front of us. The ground was an unbelievably psychedelic and detailed landscape of multicolored pebbles, plants, and moss, and it was hard to keep your eyes off of it. Bobby came up behind me and tapped me on the shoulder.
"You know, this is like being, I don't know. All I had for lunch was peanut butter."
I smiled,
but didn't say anything. I knew exactly what he was talking about. In the city, you wouldn't think twice about such patterns under your feet. You would think such simple things as small plants and stones were entirely unremarkable. But in that rarefied environment, something instantly clicked inside your brain. You became supersensitive to subtle variations of texture and color that struck you as entirely magnificent. The effect might be compared to taking a powerful shamanic concoction, but the potion was that special place itself. We began to reach the top of one crest and had long lost sight of the car. As we rounded a small outcropping of rock, we stopped and took in a view that was nothing short of breathtaking, literally.
"Hold on a minute," Bobby said. "I'm out of breath."
He bent down on his hands and on his knees.
"Wimp," I boasted. "I'm a Capricorn. What are you, Pisces the trout?"
"Hey, I'm a Capricorn too. I'm just not used to this."
"Too much pasta," I retorted.
I figure his name wasn't Bobby Spaghetti for nothing.
"You're supposed to carb up when you go on a hike, don't you know?" Bobby replied.
I chuckled to myself. Here was a young teenager, and he was having trouble keeping up with me, an old fart. Of course, I didn't dare mention that my thighs were already aching from the steep leg of the trail we had just come up. I was actually glad he wanted to rest.
"Hey, look at that,"
I pointed out the range of snow-capped peaks immediately across the valley to the west. Bobby straightened up and turned around to look.
"Oh, wow," he said, nearly under his breath. "That's incredible."
We were looking at not one, but several 14,000-foot peaks, all within eyeshot from that vantage point. The very summit of Mount Evanescence was just mere miles from where we stood. Gray and Torrey's twin Fortiners were a short distance west. Long's Peak was uprange perhaps 25 miles. Pike's Peak was a relatively far 50 miles south of where we stood. But we could see them all within an easy turn of our heads.
"Let's keep going. There's a vector window just over there," I suggested, and pointed a short distance away.
Bobby looked puzzled.
I mean, a very interesting place," I clarified.
We hiked down a bit, hopping from the top of one flat boulder to the next, but staying more or less on the crest of the rocky expanse we were exploring. To our immediate right eastward, the hillside dropped sharply, forming a wall of granite bluffs that ended 200 feet below us at the edge of the bristle cones. To our left, the side of the mountain more gradually descended into a long, deep valley. We made our way along the west side of the ridge, continually working our way higher and higher. After another 10 minutes of hiking up and down a rocky roller coaster, we came to an unexpectedly wide, flat area that was oddly private and enclosed, right in the middle of an area that was for the most part completely exposed to the elements otherwise.
"This is it,"
I said as I took off my backpack and sat down on the ground to get out a drinking bottle. "You want some?" I handed Bobby the water bottle after taking a good long swig myself.
"Short stop," he said.
I smiled. I had heard my father use that expression when I was a kid and used the salt before passing it on. My father's spirit must have been following us that afternoon. Bobby walked over to a high, solid wall of rock that sat on one side of the flat area. It was as if we had suddenly stumbled upon a big outdoor movie screen that had been carved out of the side of the mountain.
"I didn't expect to see any of this," he said as he ran his hand against the wall.
For Bobby, it all must have been quite something to encounter for the first time.
"This is awesome,"
he said, surveying the landscape. I forgave the cliché. There was also a small ledge about 3 feet off the ground at the base of the wall. I watched as Bobby contemplated the spot with his back towards me. He threw his own backpack and the umbrella on the ground. Then he placed 1 foot on the ledge, testing it for his weight. It was as if instinct took over, and he dug his fingernails into the rock face and then hoisted himself wholly onto the lip. He flattened himself against the wall, hugging it, his ear to the wall, as if he were listening to something deep inside the earth.
Looking at him flat against the rock cliff, it made the most incongruous sight. Here he was standing vertically against this nearly perfectly flat area, a wall perhaps 25 feet across and 20 feet high, and yet, from my vantage point, it looked exactly as if he were lying down on a granite bed horizontally. It was a remarkable illusion. He closed his eyes. There was no sound at all. No wind. No birds. No nothing. And then we heard in the distance, from the direction of the twisted 1,500-year-old pine trees below us, a sound as sudden as a crack of thunder piercing the clouds high above us, a sound that sent a bolt of pure electrical shock up our spines. Bobby was catapulted off the wall no different than if the wall itself had suddenly come to life and knocked him off with the force of a heavyweight boxer. But it wasn't the clouds bashing each other above our heads that we had heard. We both heard the unmistakable sustained sound of someone screaming at the top of their lungs from within the forest below, as if they were seconds away from being murdered.
"Bobby, get out!"
I yelled as I jumped to my feet, my cane in my hand held out at arm's length.
"Grab your wand, now!"